From KMXT and Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides over 58,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Continuing efforts to contain pollution from a sunken scallop boat off Kodiak Island have cost more than $3 million in less than a month. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, the wreckage of the St. Patrick lies testament to one of Alaska's deadliest fishing disasters decades ago and remains an environmental hazard today.
The St. Patrick has rested at the bottom of a women's bay for more than 30 years, a wreck nearly forgotten until August 3rd, when an alert passerby noticed an oily sheen on the water's surface. Since then, the state's Spill Prevention and Response Division has been coordinating with divers and deployed booms. Responders say around 10,000 gallons of water mixed with petroleum have been removed.
We're making really good progress on removing fuels and this oily water from the vessel so that we can make sure that it doesn't continue sheening.
Jade Gamble has been leading the state's on-scene response.
We intend to get this vessel as clean as possible so that we don't have to come back.
Records are spotty on how the derelict St. Patrick ended up on the seafloor. Officials only know it went down sometime in 1989 after being moored nearby for several years.
I'm not even for sure of a date that it actually sunk.
But the story goes back several years earlier, and for many in Kodiak's commercial fishing community, the vessel's pollution has dragged up memories of one of Alaska's most devastating fishing disasters that claimed 9 lives in 1981.
It was a mismanaged boat to begin with.
Bill Harrington is a retired commercial fisherman in Kodiak.
And then I know when it sank, the captain took the trip off and put this guy in charge that didn't have a license.
But the owners ordered the St. Patrick to fish for scallops anyway in late November. Kodiak maritime attorney Jerry Markham represented one of the two survivors and several families of victims.
And the mate went out in very serious storm and got side to the seas, and the boat rolled so far over that it took water into the air intakes and flooded the engine. And that's what caused the crew to panic.
The batteries had become waterlogged, and someone in the crew became convinced that they could explode, which was unfounded, but that was the fear. They were 13 miles offshore when the order was given to abandon ship for a life raft, but it blew out of reach. Three of the crew members didn't have survival suits, which in the frigid waters gave them only minutes to live.
The boys in survival suits, of course, they lasted, 10 hours and watched each one of them slowly die.
Only two of the 11 crew survived after washing ashore on nearby Marmot Island. The disabled St. Patrick rolled in the rough seas, but never foundered.
It's such a tragedy because of the nature of the accident, if the boys had only stayed with the boat.
It was salvaged a few days later and towed back to Women's Bay, where it remains today in 60 feet of water. Jerry Markham spent the next decade in litigation against the four principal owners of the St. Patrick's holding company. It went to federal appeals twice before the court awarded a final payout of nearly $8 million to the two survivors and the estate of 9 crew members lost in 1981. That wasn't until the late 80s, and during all that time, the abandoned St. Patrick sat in Women's Bay.
Like I said, I wasn't really concerned with the vessel. We were just looking at the situation, collecting something for the people.
Apparently nobody was, and the 20-odd ton ship rusted on its moorings while legal battles were fought onshore in federal court.
The salver, I don't know if he ever got anything out of it, but for this boat that nobody wanted to touch because it was, quote, a ghost ship.
Kodiak's harbor officials say there are no records explaining exactly when or why the ship went down. Harbor Master Mike Cernowski says he's been calling around.
And nobody really has any information, asking around to a couple other folks, so it's a difficult story to find, but we'll keep on trying to see if we can figure out if somebody here knows.
Meanwhile, first responders are moving into their second month, trying to contain any pollution from the sunken ship. The Coast Guard has tapped into federal cleanup funds, with about $3 million in public money spent so far. Efforts to track down those who could be held liable have been fruitless, says Jade Gamble, the on-scene coordinator.
Many of the businesses that owned or were involved with this vessel in the 80s are now out of business, and so there's not been a responsible party identified.
Abandoned vessels are a challenge across Alaska, with state lawmakers in recent years mandating titles to track ownership and using those fees to establish a fund to deal with derelict ships that are a hazard to navigation and the environment. Jerry Markham, the maritime lawyer, says he thought the St. Patrick was a tragedy from another era.
It's crazy that they're still having these problems with it. And modern times have changed. Like I said, they're much more concerned about pollution these days.
Hundreds of feet of boom encircle the area to keep the oily waste from reaching the shoreline. But this wrecked scallop boat that inexplicably sank more than 30 years ago still isn't completely at rest. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. For more information, call 1-907-235-4966 or online at alaskaboat.com.
During its next meeting, the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council will put the last bows and ribbons on another catch share program, one that will privatize access to all of the trawl-caught cod in the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands. Once implemented, a handful of companies and individuals will own the exclusive rights to drag for codfish across an immense area of the globe. Catch share programs are not without controversy. If you visit the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council's website, under the Publications tab, in the category Scientific Papers, you'll find at the very top a paper written by Mauricium Zimkowiak, Sarah Marinin, and Stephen Kaspersky, entitled The Pacific Halibut and Sablefish Individual Fishing Quota Program, a 20-year retrospective, which was published in the Marine Fisheries Review in 2020. In its introduction, the paper states, "Catch shares are a management tool that have been applied across the world to address overcapitalization in fisheries. However, there is growing concern that these programs can have adverse and disproportionate impacts on some participants due to the resultant consolidation and loss of access opportunities from high entry costs." It goes on to say, "Initial distributions, consolidation, and individual fishing quota leasing, among other factors, may also lead to intergenerational inequities in access and opportunities within and across communities." Well, that all sounds very scientific, but what does it mean? Well, overcapitalization just means that prior to the halibut and sablefish catch share programs, there were so many boats fishing so successfully that some seasons lasted only days, with boats fishing ridiculous amounts of gear at a frenzied pace and dumping the fish onto the market all at once, increasing the cost of production and decreasing quality and the price paid to fishermen. Handing out access rights in the form of quota shares to select fishermen slowed the fishery down, improving quality, serving the market better, and tipping the balance of market power in favor of harvesters. Most people would admit that catch share programs do a good job of addressing overcapitalization. But what about intergenerational inequities in access and opportunities within and across communities? That doesn't sound too good. Well, intergenerational inequities refers to the difference between the fisherman initially allocated quota share and the entry-level fisherman who must purchase the rights. Quote, "Unless otherwise addressed, inequities in the generational distribution of catch share benefits may be inherent to this type of management regime. When an IFQ system gives rise to resource rents and quota shares are freely allocated to initial recipients, with no mechanism for collecting some of this rent by resource managers, most of the resource rent may be captured by the first generation of quota shareholders when they exit and sell their shares, and that value is paid by the incoming shareholders. Furthermore, the acquisition of quota shares is fundamentally different for initial recipients and new entrant quota shareholders. Initial recipients may utilize their initially allocated QS as collateral for loans or subsidize the purchase of additional QS through revenues generated from harvest of IFQ derived from initially allocated QS, opportunities that do not exist for new entrants." So, When we assign initial recipients of catch shares their quota shares, we create kind of a new class of fishermen. While the entry-level or second-generation fisherman must purchase his rights to access the fishery, the initial recipient can use his allocation as collateral for loans and to generate revenue to purchase more access rights. The entry-level fisherman finds himself doubly disadvantaged in that he must pay for his access, and those fees cut into his bottom line and his ability to purchase more rights for himself. To again quote the study, coupled with decreasing crew employment opportunities in the IFQ fisheries due to consolidation and increases in lease rates, high QS prices have made entry into the IFQ fisheries prohibitive for many individuals. Unquote. Indeed, most of those entry-level fishermen start out as deckhands, and the designers of the halibut and sablefish catch share programs were concerned about the negative effects for deckhands. The problem is that statistically, deckhands don't exist. The, quote, lack of any data on crew members in the IFQ fisheries precluded a systematic examination of IFQ impacts on crew employment in terms of number of jobs, duration, seasonality, earnings, upward mobility, etc., unquote. Along with the need to better identify the objectives of the program, this need for data on the people affected by it was singled out as a glaring deficiency, one that should be addressed in future programs. If only there was a way to track crew better. If only we had the foresight years ago to implement a program that would simply and efficiently gather data on fishermen working in Alaska. Actually, we did. 12 years ago, in 2009, Governor Palin approved the funding for the Department of Fish and Game to begin an overhaul of the state's system for collecting labor data on Alaska's seafood harvesters based on an updated crew license. Here's how the research firm Northern Economics described their participation. Quote, sometimes we are blessed with the joy of watching an obviously beneficial and feasible project move from proposal to analysis to action, close quote. They go on to say, accurate data on participation is important for both the communities crew members call home and for the crew members themselves. Without accurate data, fishing communities find it difficult to prove to policymakers, granting agencies, or lawmakers that their communities are integrally tied to fisheries. Partnering with the Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference, Fish and Game made significant progress, until a United Fishermen of Alaska representative abruptly announced during a planning meeting that they had lobbied then-Governor Parnell to quash the project, saying their leadership objected on grounds that the information gathered might be private. Federal law already requires complete transparency from fish harvesting businesses, but without the governor's support, the Seafood Harvesting Labor Data Project died instantly, never to be revived. Catch share programs continue to be touted as a new wave in fisheries management. No plan seems to be on the table to address intergenerational inequities.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice-weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted, hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amsea.org or 907-747-3287.